We're hearing from teacher union presidents on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Earlier this week, unions representing five of our state's largest school districts applied pressure on the Evers administration to keep classrooms closed this fall. And collectively, the unions say they represent more than 10,000 public education workers. Milwaukee and Madison districts announced last week they plan to start the school year with virtual instruction only. Should schools reopen for the classroom this fall? Parents, do you feel comfortable sending your child back to school? Would they wear a mask? Teachers, what do you think about returning to the classroom? What guidance has come down from your district? We're at 800-642-1234. Amy Mizialko is president of the Milwaukee Teachers Education Association, and she's been a special education teacher for 28 years. Amy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you.
And we also have Angelina Cruz, president of Racine Educators United. Angelina has taught in Racine for 17 years. Angelina, welcome to you.
Good morning. Thank you.
Well, Angelina, let's start with you. As you, a union leader, why do you think Wisconsin is ill-prepared for in-person education?
Oh, well. So I, you know, from my perspective, all decisions at this point in the midst of a pandemic need to be based upon the science of what's happening. We're learning new things every day. While Wisconsin reported around 1,117 new cases recently, Illinois, with twice our population, reported 955. And so in Wisconsin, our cases are routinely surging to new records in the recent days and weeks. And from my perspective, what has to be at the forefront of any decision making is the safety of our children and the safety of educators.
Amy, what concerns you about teachers returning to the classroom?
I think, you know, of great concern is the fact that there are approximately 13,000 public school districts trying to make 13,000 different decisions. And so we have seen an absolute failure of government at the federal level, with a president standing in front of a raging inferno telling us that there is nothing wrong. And in addition to that, Wisconsin is the state, a state with the second fewest safeguards in place to protect students and school staff and really Wisconsinites and the entire community.
And do you mean that in terms of mask wearing or other safety precautions as well?
Other safety precautions as well. So we have right now, Wisconsin is listed as a state with uncontrolled spread of coronavirus. And as Angelina mentioned, new case records on a regular basis. And so we don't have control of the virus in the state of Wisconsin. And we certainly, you know, we need to get to a place where there is clear containment, where we see a sharp reversal of the current trend. But without that, there is no opportunity for an in-person reopening because there is an undue risk, and it's our job to keep students, workers, and families safe.
Angelina, I want to pose this to you. The letter from the five unions is addressed to the governor, but also the health secretary designee, Andrea Palm, and state superintendent, Carolyn Stanford Taylor. What actions do you want out of them from, you know, in terms of the fall?
So I think the five urban presidents who jointly signed on to this letter recognize that we have a governor who, frankly, is an educator. I do believe that he is on his side in doing the best that he can in the political landscape that is Wisconsin. But we have a state legislature that is frankly putting, money, they're prioritizing profits over people and putting, you know, our most precious resources, our children, in harm's way. And it's time for them to stop playing politics. So frankly, our ask to those three leaders is to set the stage and to make it clear to the people of Wisconsin what is actually happening in our state house as far as the decision makers who have the majority in the state house, and to move them to do the right thing by our children and to stop playing politics with them.
We're talking with Angelina Cruz, president of Racine Educators United. Amy Mizialko is president of the Milwaukee Teachers Education Association, along with three other teachers union leaders. They've called for remote learning for our state students this fall. You can join in with your questions and insights. How did virtual learning go for your child when school was in session? What did you find successful? Where are the challenges? Do you think it's doable for the fall? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Angelina, following up there on what the Evers administration can do, the state Supreme Court struck down the statewide stay-at-home order in May. Are you confident that public officials that you've written to would have the ability to craft a statewide remote education mandate?
Frankly, I'm not. I think so. What we are witnessing statewide is, and Amy, you know, made an allusion to this, is that we've got every local municipality is being left to make decisions on the fly with no uniform guidance, either at the state level or the national level. And so that's the call. And whether you are a Republican or a Democrat or whatever your shade of political allegiance is, we all need to come together. And I speak as a Wisconsinite. This is a Wisconsin problem that all Wisconsinites need to rally around and come together and have one plan and march forward so that we can come through this pandemic in the best possible way.
Amy, I want to look at vulnerable students for a moment. What impact do you think reopening schools would have on our state's students of color and their families?
So we are living in a time that is really incomprehensible for most people. You know, this is a crisis that, according to the CDC, could have been under control within 4 to 8 weeks of universal mask wearing. And instead, this has dragged on for months. And as Angelina said, with the emphasis being on short-term profits over long-term public health. And you've seen our nation choose Disney World and bars and restaurants over students and, you know, controlling the virus so that students can be in person. So we're extremely concerned about inequities, I mean, pre-COVID, inequities in the state of Wisconsin for children of color are the nation's worst. And so in the midst of a pandemic, we need federal relief for our communities, for our students. And it's an absolute failure of federal government to not have rushed to the forefront to ensure that there were safeguards and funding for students. So this isn't, not being able to open isn't the fault of schools or teachers or parents, but it's a failure of right-wing politicians.
We have to pause there with Amy Mizialko, Angelina Cruz, teacher union presidents. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're checking in with a pair of teacher union presidents getting their assessment of how to deliver education this fall. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and they're among the five largest districts in the state collectively speaking out against classroom instruction as the Number of new COVID cases in Wisconsin reached an all-time high this week. The five districts say they represent more than 10,000 public education workers who educate over 160,000 public school students. Should schools reopen this fall, what should that decision be based on? Educators, what guidance is coming down from your district? Time to talk, 800-642-1234. We have Amy Mizialko, president of the Milwaukee Teachers Education Association, and Angelina Cruz, president of Racine Educators United, and they stay with us for 10 more minutes. Let's take a call now. Tammy is with us from Mason. Hi, Tammy.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
And I hope you guys are all safe. But, okay, I got a question. Okay, I'm divorced, and we got 50-50. And so he wants the kids to go to school, and I don't, because if anybody is infected, they're going to just spread it, and they're going to give it to my child or the teachers and stuff. So is there any kind of legal stuff I can do to make sure I want them still online? And they are computer savvies. Is there anything I can do to keep everything safe?
Tammy, thank you for the call. Angelina, I'm going to field this to you. What about family differences in how we take risks during COVID?
That is an excellent question that I have not yet fielded. So I can appreciate that's got to be a difficult situation to navigate. You know, I would look for guidance, legal guidance, in terms of what your options are.
Tammy, thank you for the call. And Amy, would you like to add anything?
I am sitting here wincing, listening to that question and what a difficult situation it is. I know I have nothing further to add. Legal guidance. Is recommended.
Let's bring in Patricia now in Minocqua. Hi, Patricia.
Hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
With that virtual learning, how are you going to keep kids in the mode to do it when they don't really want to do the homework or anything? And then once if they do go back to school, how are you going to keep them to wear the mask?
Patricia, thank you for that. Amy, I will pose that to you. How do you keep students engaged in the virtual setting? And by the way, maybe parents are working at home and they can't be there to help their child through the homework and classwork.
Absolutely. So, you know, I think it's important for everyone listening to recognize that this is a nationwide issue and we are in the midst of crisis, emergency teaching and learning. Over all of that is this issue of Wi-Fi and guaranteed connectivity, because we know that there are thousands of families across the state of Wisconsin, outstate, rural, and certainly in cities that do not have access, guaranteed access to Wi-Fi and connectivity. And in 2020, that's an absolutely necessity. And in this pandemic, it's an absolute equity concern that has to be addressed. We absolutely feel for and hear parents are listening and really trying to get prepared to do the very best, most engaging, remote teaching and learning in this crisis that we can do. And, we're concerned for every student, and especially students with IEPs, students with 504 plans, students
individualized education plans.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Angelina, how do you make a productive learning environment at home when there are so many stresses?
So that is a great question, and that is something that, as Amy alluded to, this is emergency crisis teaching and learning. We are responding in the best ways that we can, trying to connect. I know in Racine, we're trying to connect with our students and their families to assess their needs. I think that's absolutely critical. And this is a new landscape. So we are doing our best to adjust on the fly to address those needs and to assure students have what they need. But I also want to point out our national affiliate, the NEA, National Education Association, and our state affiliate, the Wisconsin Education Association Council, they have both put forward plans which mitigate risk, which really speak to the things that we as five urban locals have asked to. So whether it's that we are returning to school, that we have proper resources to ensure the safety of people in physical spaces, physical distancing, reducing the number of contacts, face coverings, hand washing, daily health screenings, or if, as Amy was speaking to, it's addressing the need for access to internet and devices for all students, because we know that is an issue that spans whether you're an urban district or a rural district. Those are very serious issues that need to be addressed. But really, the funding is really being held hostage by our legislators. So people really need to call on, whether it's our state legislators or our federal legislation, Congress people, call on them to act and be responsible and stop holding our kids hostage and provide for them the resources that they need to survive and thrive through this pandemic.
We're with Angelina Cruz, president of Racine Educators United there. Amy Mizialko is here, president of the Milwaukee Teachers Education Association. Let's take another call. Jeremy is with us from Racine. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think we really need to open up these schools in a manner that you got to think outside the box. If you feel that it's a danger to have X amount of students in a classroom, let's look at two days where you have half the student body showing up for a school, and then maybe Thursday, Friday, have the other half of the student body show up, and then use Wednesdays as a catch-up for the teachers or something like that, or to sanitize their classrooms, things like that. Maybe eat lunch inside the classroom instead of congregate them inside the big lunchrooms and stuff like that, bring the meals to the kids in the classrooms. There are ways we could do this that is still safe. It's already known that children have a low risk from when they catch COVID, if they do catch it, to have a major impact on their health. It's just the older populations that we have to worry about and protect, older teachers, things like that, wear face coverings and things like that. There are places around the world that are doing this right now, and it seems to be working. It's a little bit rocky, but it's something, and it's better than just shutting the schools down completely and saying, wait until this is all over, because this may not be over for another year or so. And we can't afford to have our children not have education for over a year.
Jeremy, thank you for this. Angelina, in Racine, Jeremy advocating for a hybrid model. What would you say?
That's all the points that you made are completely valid. And I would like to say that in terms of Racine Unified School District in collaboration with educators, period, and staff that are working in the buildings, those have been discussions in terms of the hybrid model. I think that Racine has come up with as good a plan in all three scenarios as they possibly could have. So I have no criticisms of our district in terms of that. But I want to point to the fact that, again, I'm going to circle back to CDC and the science of where we're at in this moment in time. There, without any containment of COVID-19, remote learning, our distance learning, whatever we are referring to it as now, is the only safest option. The CDC has categorized fully reopening schools as the highest risk option, and that the more people interact and the longer they interact, the higher the risk of COVID-19 spread. And so we are in a state where it is exploding right now. In Racine, we have one of the highest cases per capita counties or cities in the state of Wisconsin. And so that has to really be at the forefront of any decision making that we are considering at the end of the day. Our district is supposed to release their decision on Friday, and I'm hoping that they're putting the health and safety of children and our educators, especially considering that we know one in four educators is in a higher risk category, making them more vulnerable to COVID-19. That was a finding just issued by the Kaiser Family Foundation recently. And so health and safety has to come first. And to be clear, I mean, distance remote learning is still learning. We're going to have to figure out what that looks like. Schools will still be open. It's just going to look vastly different than it has, frankly, from what in our lifetimes have experienced. So many
issues to work through. Angelina, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Angelina Cruz, president of Racine Educators United. And Amy, thank you for being here.
Thanks so much. I just want to say, please call on Secretary Palm to take statewide action to protect the public health of Wisconsinites. Classrooms and schools are closed and crowded spaces with close sustained contact. And that is an absolute defiance of what science tells us to do. We believe Secretary Palm has the power to do something.
Amy Mizialko, president of the Milwaukee Teachers Education Union. News is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us as we talk about transportation projects and budgeting here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin has close to 130 construction projects underway or scheduled for construction this year. That's according to the State Transportation Department's 511 Interactive Construction Map that divides the state into five regions, gives a detailed overview of each project and its timeline. What do you want to know about the status of state highway construction goals or plans? Which fixes are the most important to you? How are the roads where you live? We're at 800-642-1234. Craig Thompson is Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. Secretary Thompson, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Well, Governor Evers just announced another $250 million in cuts to state agency budgets this fiscal year. It comes on top of the $70 million round of reductions in April. What does this latest reduction mean for transportation and your budget in particular?
Well, you know, I think the state is experiencing what every, you know, business around the state is experiencing, is that the COVID pandemic is certainly wreaking havoc in budgets, and I know Governor Evers wants us to be as proactive as possible and come up with those reductions, you know, sooner rather than later. The announcement that he made yesterday really is for the general fund. Transportation is funded really as sort of a largely separate budget that we, our fees, or our revenue rather, comes in from gas taxes and registration fees and titling fees, and so we're going to have our own challenges because at the end of the day, our revenues have to, our expenditures have to meet our revenues. So we're continuing to look at that, but it's going to be significant belt tightening all the way around.
But a quarter of your revenue and what your budget is made up are federal dollars. How instrumental is that money?
That's a great question. And that's right. A quarter of our total budget is federal dollars. And then the road side, it's over 50%. So what the federal government does, both in terms of coming up with whether they're going to come up with any stimulus type package on the transportation side, or even they're scheduled for to renew their transportation federal plan. Both of those are going to loom large in terms of what it means for Wisconsin transportation.
A couple weeks ago, Governor Evers announced that the administration would try to revive the expansion of I-94. Are costs still a concern with this project?
Well, you know, costs are always a concern, but this is, for people not familiar, this is the stretch of I-94 really in front of Miller Park. It lies in between the Zoo Interchange and the Marquette Interchange, and we really just believe that we can't ignore it. Like other parts of the interstate that had not been rebuilt, it's over 60 years old, which means that not that it needs to be repaved, but it needs to be rebuilt. So we believe it's incumbent upon us to start the process of doing all the environmental studies, the traffic studies, reaching out and talking with the public, and doing it in a way that we think is going to make the most sense to get the most investment out of the interchanges we already built on both sides.
What is the price tag with it in 2020 dollars and going forward?
Well, part of the process that we just started up again that the governor announced is going to be coming up with a more up-to-date fiscal estimate. The best numbers we have are a couple years old, and that was at $834 million.
And what would be the timeline for this?
Well, the process right now is that we look at what was called the preferred alternative, which means there was a lot of negotiations that had gone on with community stakeholders in the department that ruled out some things. Like some might remember that there was looking at, for a while, a double-decker option by Story Hill, which a lot of people had concerns with. That was ruled out. Changing the Hawley interchange so that the city of West Dallas, that there could be better connectivity. So what we're looking at is confirming that those where we got to still is working, that the environmental and traffic and other things still make sense, reaching out, having meetings with the public, and then really convincing the federal government that we've gone through all the necessary steps that you have to do for a project like this. And we think in order to do that, we're guessing that'll take a year to 18 months, and then we're hopeful at that point in time that the federal government will approve and give what they call a record of decision so that the state could begin to move forward.
And how much will the federal funding of dollars, if that is approved, what would be the stake from federal funds?
Well, we don't know exactly what portion would be the federal funds, but, you know, with these what we call mega projects on the interstate and southeast, there's a significant amount of federal and bond dollars involved.
In terms of what it would take in labor costs and in labor and in hiring, how many workers would be on that project roughly?
Well, that's one of the things I think will be exciting for people right now with the economy and people looking for jobs. We think just on the labor side of designing and constructing this, it will produce about 6,000 to 10,000 jobs in the area.
We're talking with Craig Thompson, Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Transportation, looking at transportation funding and projects amid the pandemic. With your insights, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Chris now in Milwaukee. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. Transportation time, rush hour transportation time in Milwaukee is some of the best in the country, whereas our mass transit in Milwaukee and in the state is some of the worst in the country. We are not, it doesn't do us a lot of monetary good to go and fix something that's not a big problem and not fix things that are a big problem. Don't spend the money on that freeway. Spend it on mass transit. Thank you.
Chris, thank you for the call. Secretary Thompson, what are the projects on the mass transportation front in Milwaukee in particular?
Well, I understand what Chris said, and while I do believe that it's we don't have any choice, this needs to be rebuilt, I do agree that we need to do a lot better on the public transportation, mass transit side, not only in Milwaukee, but across Wisconsin. We are looking at doing as much as we can. The Evers administration is very interested in improving the mass transit situation in Milwaukee. I don't think it has to be an either or. And as a matter of fact, as part of this project, we believe that there will be some what is known as mitigation dollars that we can partner with Milwaukee County and the Milwaukee County Transit System to hopefully improve and build upon. We were very excited to see Milwaukee County receive a $40 million grant from the federal government to get bus rapid transit really up and going in the Milwaukee area. And we want to do what we can to be as helpful as we can. We believe we can, through this project, do some things to help. But through the overall budget, we also have
like
to,
what would help? Like, where would those dollars go? How would they help?
Well, for operations, increased dollars for operations, perhaps for buses for the Milwaukee County Transit System. But the more you can make stops accessible and frequent and predictable, the more access that we can get to the inner city of Milwaukee, all those things are going to help the transit system in Milwaukee. And like I said, getting a bus rapid transit system, which is really it's a bus system that's going to run east-west, and you get through, there's the lights talk with the bus, and there's fewer stops, and it almost acts more like a train. I think that's really going to be exciting in Milwaukee. But part of what we have to do is convince the legislature as well through the budget process, because that part, the Governor Evers had proposed larger increases for mass transit in the last budget, but they got pared down significantly before it got to the final product.
You mentioned the word train. Is there any movement on that front and rail systems?
Well, we've actually been very successful in the last year and a half on garnering more federal funding for passenger rail. We've gotten quite a bit of money. We're going to be expanding at what's known as Muskego Yards and really looking to increase, you know, once we're post-pandemic and things get back more to normal. There's 7 round trips daily right now on the Hiawatha line between Chicago and Milwaukee, and we're looking to increase that eventually to 10 round trips a day. And we also just recently received a grant to improve upon the what we're going to be looking at is the Twin Cities to Madison to Chicago line, which is currently part of the Empire Builder line, but really enhancing just that part from Chicago to Minneapolis. So we've made some pretty significant increases on passenger rail recently.
Would that mean additional stops? Would that mean more ability to get on that train in other areas? What would it mean?
Sure. So for the Hiawatha one, it just means more round trips with the current stops between Milwaukee and Chicago. With the one between Minneapolis and Chicago, right now it's called the Empire Building and it's Empire Builder, and it starts in Minneapolis and it goes all the way out to Portland on the West Coast, and which is wonderful. But it makes when you have that long of a trip, it makes the stops a little less reliable. By getting this grant and putting another one on that same line, but will only go from Chicago to Minneapolis, we believe we can increase the on-time amount significantly, which will allow folks in the area to set up more reliable transit connections to those stops and know exactly when they're going to be there. So we think it could really enhance the ridership between the Twin Cities and Chicago.
Let's bring in Ron now, joining us from Madison. Hi, Ron.
Thanks. COVID is killing government budgets from the tiny rural towns through the United Nations and the European Union. Finish up projects that are more than 80% completed, like Walker's Illinois to Madison, 5th and 6th lanes. There are probably several others around the state. Most of the other projects should be mothballed. Finish up little segments so it's safe, and then get all the construction equipment and orange barrels off the highway for the next, whatever, 5 months to 5 years, whatever it takes for the economy to recover enough. We have to focus our limited government dollars on projects that are essential to saving lives from the COVID virus. Put the money into the health departments. Get it out of the highway departments.
Ron, thank you for the call. And I'm going to have Secretary Designee Craig Thompson here respond to you in just a moment as we talk through a range of infrastructure issues in our state. Where should our state find money to fix its roads? Do you support raising gas taxes, installing tolls, or changing the state's roads network in another way? How do you think our state should handle its transportation amid COVID? Be part of this. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We will be back in a moment with Secretary Designee Craig Thompson right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The western part of our state has been hit by repeated flood damage with washed out roads and culverts. A rural road may be the one lifeline out of a small town. Crumbling roads have both safety and economic consequences. We're looking at the competing infrastructure challenges around our state and what to do about them amid COVID. Still time, 800-642-1234. Craig Thompson is Secretary Designee of the State Transportation Department. Stays with us for 10 more minutes. Secretary, we heard Ron there in Madison saying finish up the projects underway and shift those infrastructure dollars to fight the health crisis that's in front of us. What would you say?
Well, I would agree with the first part of what Ron said, which is that the COVID pandemic is wreaking havoc on budgets everywhere and on the economy. I would disagree with the second part of what he said. First of all, we don't have the ability to do that. Their constitution, there was a constitutional amendment that was passed overwhelmingly several years ago that says the money that's deposited into the transportation fund as a result of transportation user fees like gas tax and registration fees has to be spent on transportation. So we can't take those transportation user fees and send them to the general fund for health programs and others. But we do need to be as intentional as possible and making sure, again, we have to make our budget work. So for fiscal year 20, which ended on July 30th, we ended up holding back and saved about $120 million. And for fiscal year 21, which runs till next to June 30th of 2021, we're going to be looking at making sure that we're keeping our expenditures in line with what our revenues are going to be. And they did take a hit in reduced gas tax revenues.
With people not driving as much anywhere.
Right. During March and April, driving was down a lot, to almost 50%. May, it was back up more. In June, now it's down a little bit, but not down as much. So we're going to be keeping really close tabs on those. But, you know, at the very beginning, you know, you had talked about how we had 130 projects this year. We actually have 130 active projects now. We have 371 for this year, and we're keeping them all going. And because that's a really important part of the economy, too. If we pulled the plug on those, not only would it add cost to those projects to stop and start again, but it would have a significant impact on the economy by all the workers that would be laid off that are designing and building all these projects. And by keeping these projects ongoing, and we've been able to keep them going through this with less traffic, we've been able to actually speed up some projects. We believe it may make us eligible for some additional federal funds. And so while we have to make sure that we're very cognizant of the revenue we have coming in, we believe that keeping transportation investment moving forward, as we've seen in other economic downturns, is a really important part of keeping the economy going.
I want to talk about bridges for a moment. Last year, the state identified necessary repairs on nearly 2,000 bridges in the state, an estimated cost of $1.4 billion. What is the status of bridge repair?
So, you know, like so much of our infrastructure in this country, you know, we've got a long way to go, but we've had a very successful bridge program. We've embarked on some new programs with our local partners at the county level and municipal level to try to bundle some projects, to try to come up with some bridge strengthening programs where you don't have to rebuild the bridge, but can for much less find successful ways and safe ways to strengthen those bridges. And then, you know, some of those bridges come in and are swallowed up as part of overall projects, such as the East-West project in Milwaukee we just talked about. There's numerous bridges that will be done as a part of that. So we've got a ways to go, but we're in pretty good shape of really starting to really make a lot of progress on our bridges in Wisconsin.
So bridges that would be deemed structurally deficient that need urgent repair, you're able to fix those bridges with the dollars that you have?
We are definitely reducing the number that are on that list. And I know the term structurally deficient, it sounds very scary to people. It doesn't mean it's unsafe to drive. It's a fairly technical term. But it does mean that it's on our list that we need to work through and make sure that we get repaired. We have people out testing those all the time, and they will be weight restricted or posted if there's any concern about safety. But we want to avoid that as much as possible, because once we weight restrict, then that has an effect on commerce as well.
Talking with Craig Thompson, Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Transportation, looking at state transportation issues and budgets. Taking another call now, Jim is with us from Freedom. Hi, Jim.
Yes. I was wondering if the state ever looks at some flaw designs in engineering. One example I see is roundabouts. When you're coming off a four-lane highway onto a two-lane highway, you make two complete roundabouts on each side, or complete one on each side instead of making an oblongated one. I talked to one of your own engineers, and he said it would probably save you about $10,000 per interchange if you eliminated the inner loop on each side of the highway, which never gets used. I drive through them, and you can see gravel sitting on the cars that have never used these things. It seems you guys need maybe to reevaluate what you're doing and think about how to save money, because there's eight of these such interchanges in Outagamie and Brown County alone. Would have saved $80,000, according to one of your own engineers.
Jim, thank you. And I want to get Secretary here to respond to that.
Sure. No, I think with Jim's, you know, we've directed our people to be constantly reviewing whether it's roundabouts or whether it's materials or whatever it is. And there's a lot of technical review committees, and we have a lot of peer review, and we talk constantly with our counterparts in other states to make sure that we are analyzing what we have done and what we are doing to make sure we're getting the best use of our dollars.
Have roundabouts been used a long time, or, you know, is there something that is more popular with them in the moment of architecture infrastructure?
Well, you know, roundabouts were very, very popular for a while in terms, when I say popular, I mean a popular topic. And a lot of people really had big concerns with them. And we've seen a lot of that change. There's a lot of, we have a lot of communities now that are really asking for roundabouts. We have seen the safety improvements as a result of them. And I think the traveling public is getting more used to them. But we do want to continue to look at metrics and let numbers drive our decisions about where we're, whether it's roundabouts or anything else, to make sure that we're increasing safety as much as we possibly can and improving efficiency.
I want to look at western Wisconsin now with so much repeated flood damage there. Are roads and culverts getting the attention they need to get up to, you know, to get repaired?
Well, that's a really, really good question, Kate. It's one thing about getting the attention to be repaired, but there are areas we see in Wisconsin and across this country where we're seeing repeated flooding. And so what's known as resiliency is becoming a very hot topic about, in certain parts, do we need to build to a higher standard? Do we need to change the way we, rather than just rebuilding something to be washed out again, we need to really be looking at, in areas of persistent flooding, how we're engineering and designing those culverts and roads when we're replacing them.
Let's look at rural parts of our state. Many small communities may have one state highway or one main road out of that town. How much attention do you give to rural parts of our state that really rely on one road to be in good condition?
It's hugely important. And if you look at this last budget, we didn't get everything that we had hoped for, but it was the first budget in decades, really, that had new revenue sources raised to go into transportation. And of the more than $400 million that was raised new, all of it went to trying to fix what we currently have. It either went into we increased the aids to our towns and cities and counties and villages by 10%, over $80 million. And almost all the rest of the increase went into what is known as the State Highway Rehabilitation Program. And that is designed at simply fixing those two-lane state highways that we already have to get them in better repair. So that is really where our focus has been.
So many people getting hit by potholes. Do you have a centralized database of potholes and how to get them fixed quickly?
We have a centralized database of road condition, whether it's alligator cracking, whether it's heaving, whether it's potholes. But we don't have, it's not necessarily under the category of pothole.
What should someone do if they hit a major pothole, have damage to their car? How should they best report it?
Well, a lot of times it'll depend on what type of road you're on. If you're on a city street or a county highway or a state highway, more often than not, it might be you're on a local road and you may want to, get in touch with your city or county or village.
Really quickly here, as we wrap up, what are you grappling with right now? What is keeping you up at night?
Well, you know, we are definitely watching the revenues right now to see how they're coming in and balancing those with really trying to keep on a schedule to meet the mass transit needs that we had talked about, the road needs. There's a lot of need out there. There's a lot of roads that are not in the condition they need to be. And we're just hoping that we can manage our way through this crisis and come out the other end, that we can continue to make progress and get the roads and our mass transit systems in better condition.
Secretary Thompson, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Kate.
Craig Thompson is Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.